The drunk is still pissing, still humming, when Jesse leaves the bathroom. Jesse walks some distance along the concourse before ducking into an alcove, where he pulls the money from the wallet and drops the wallet to the ground. He counts the bills while waiting in line at a concession stand. $50, a decent score. The announcer reminds everyone about the upcoming bicentennial fireworks spectacular. A night of patriotic fun for the whole family. Jesse was born in the centennial year, 1876, and he'd swear more than 100 years have passed since then. It feels to him he's been on the roam forever. He steps up to the counter and orders a dog for Edgar and a beer for himself. Back in the stands, the drunk is on his knees, searching for his wallet. He tosses aside empty popcorn boxes and drink cups and brushes peanut shells off his palms. I know I had it, he says. You guys saw? Jesse, coming up the steps, freezes. Not because he's worried about the drunk fingering him, but because Edgar isn't in his seat. He scans the crowd, trying to recall what his brother is wearing. Jeans and his favorite Mickey Mouse t-shirt. He's been going on about catching a foul ball, so maybe he moved closer to the field. But there's no sign of him on the rail, either. He slipped away before, and Jesse usually finds him within a few minutes, quaking with fear, his wanderlust having faded as soon as he got out of sight of his brother. 3 years ago, though, things played out differently in a way that's troubled Jesse ever since. They got separated at a county fair in Butte, Montana, and when Jesse eventually tracked Edgar down, he was walking hand in hand with a little boy toward the exit. "What are you doing?" Jesse asked Edgar. "I'm hungry," Edgar replied. It had been only 2 weeks since he'd last fed, too soon for bloodlust. "Let the boy go," Jesse said. "I won't," Edgar said, and pulled the kid closer. The boy started to cry. "Let him go or I'll dust you where you stand," Jesse said. Edgar hesitated, reluctant to give in, but he could see Jesse meant business. He released the boy, who dashed off, and Jesse grabbed Edgar by the neck and hustled him out to the parking lot before there was any trouble. Back at their motel, Jesse alternated between punching and threatening him. "I say when it's time for you to feed, and I do the hunting," he said. "I know," Edgar said. "You don't have the brains to do for yourself. You'll get us both killed. I know." Edgar's never again shown an inclination to satisfy his bloodlust on his own, and Jesse's been hoping that what happened was a one-time thing. But what if it wasn't? He sprints down the concourse, calling for his brother into every restroom and pausing at every concession stand to make sure he's not there trying to wheedle a hot dog. When he gets to the end, he turns around to make another pass, his heart kicking at his ribs and his mouth so dry it's work to swallow. He wonders if Edgar's in the parking lot, looking for the car, wonders if he remembers they swapped the Ford for a Grand Prix last night. He comes to a door he missed before and pushes it open to reveal a stairwell. "Edgar!" he shouts. An echo, then silence. "Don't be scared, buddy. I'm not mad at you." He hears a shuffle and a faint. "I ain't scared." Edgar peers over the railing of a landing 2 stories up. "What's going on?" Jesse says. "I seen a rover." "You sure?" "He glowed black." He's talking about the dark aura surrounding rovers that only other rovers can see. "What you always say to? Took cover." "Because there are berserkers out there. Rovers who wouldn't hesitate, who would in fact relish the opportunity to dust another rover with an eye toward cutting down on the competition for prey. It's for this reason Jesse avoids others who've turned, and why he's tried to instill a fear of strangers in Edgar." "You did good," he says. "Let's get our asses out of here." As Edgar starts down the stairs, a commotion rattles the walls. Cheering, stomping. A home run. "What about my hot dog?" Edgar says. "I'll get you one on the way out," Jesse says. "Can I pay for it myself?" Jesse fishes a dollar out of his pocket and hands it to his brother. "A dollar will buy 2, Edgar says. "So get 2, Jesse says. He pulls open the door and leads Edgar through the crowd. If he really did see a rover, the rover likely saw him, so the quicker they leave the stadium, the better. Jesse isn't quite ready to go back to the motel. He's all wound up and could use a drink. He and Edgar drive down Central Avenue. The street is clogged with cruisers, a slow-moving procession of greasers gunning cherry hot rods and high school kids packed into sedans and lumbering station wagons borrowed from their parents. Every window is down, every radio is on, and a sticky sweet top 40 cacophony floats above the revving engines and car-to-car sass. Take the money and run. Love machine. Jive talking. Edgar knows all the songs and sings along. They come to a bowling alley. That'll do. Edgar likes to bowl, or try to anyway. Most of his throws end up in the gutter, but toppling even a few pins is enough to make him happy. Jesse rents shoes for him and helps him pick out a ball, then parks himself at the bar where he can keep an eye on his lane. The girl tending bar asks what he'll have. He starts to order a beer, but is struck dumb. The bartender is the spinning image of Claudine. Beautiful, doomed Claudine. Dead, oh Christ, some 70 years now. The only woman he ever loved. The only woman he'll ever love. "Need a minute," this bartender says. Same skin the color of red elm heartwood. Same green eyes that shine as if lit from behind. Same long black hair, only not worn loose, but plaited into two braids that hang past her shoulders. "I'll have a course," he manages to say.
"Jesse! Hey, Jesse!"
He turns to see Edgar pointing at 5 pins he's down and gives him the thumbs up. The girl sets a bottle in front of him.
"Sat your friend," she says.
"My brother," he says. He keeps staring at Edgar so he doesn't stare at her.
"Why aren't you playing too?"
"He has more fun on his own."
"Nah, you're afraid he'll beat you."
Jesse smiles. Claudine liked to joke around too. He gathers himself and turns to face the girl.
"Ain't you smart," he says. "And don't you forget it."
"What's your name, smarty pants?"
"Jehona. It's Navajo."
"You're an Indian."
"My mom is. My dad's Dutch."
Claudine kept changing her story. Sometimes she was Spanish, sometimes French, sometimes a gypsy princess. "How'd that happen?" Jesse asks Jehona, talking about her parents.
"My dad came over here to study Indians," Jehona says. "He's an archaeologist. You know what that is?"
"Someone who studies old things," Jesse says. "Ancient civilizations."
"You're pretty smart yourself," Jehona says. "What's your name?"
"Jesse."
"Pleased to meet you, Jesse."
Jehona goes off to see to other customers. Jesse watches her out of the corner of his eye. Can't stop. Claudine, in tight jeans and a black tank top. She's got an easy way with people, knows what to say to make them feel good. A nice girl. Claudine wanted to be nice, but because she was a huntress at heart, used kindness mainly as a lure. Jesse checks on Edgar. He's getting ready to roll. He apes the form of the bowler next to him, but his ball still ends up in the gutter. The clatter of falling pins from the other lanes is as sharp and startling as firecrackers. It bounces off the high-arched ceiling and returns twice as loud. Jehona replaces Jesse's empty bottle with a full one.
"On me," she says.
"Thanks."
"Where are you from?"
"Guess."
"Not here. Somewhere down south?"
"West Virginia, but it's been a while since I've been back."
"So you live in Phoenix now?"
"Passing through. Got work in Denver."
"Doing what?"
"Construction."
"Construction," Jehona says. "You're as pale as a ghost. Give me your hand."
She runs her thumbs over Jesse's palm, his fingers. He remembers Claudine's touch and breaks a little inside.
"You aren't a construction worker," she says.
"What am I then?" Jesse says.
"You're a bank robber."
"You get a lot of bank robbers in here."
"No, but we get a hell of a lot of construction workers. I'm on the lookout for something more exciting."
"Exciting can go different ways."
"At this point, I'm up for anything."
Two drunks at the end of the bar call for another round. Jesse forces himself to get up when Jehona goes off to serve them. He could stay here all night, watching her and seeing Claudine. But what's the point? She's not Claudine. Claudine's dead. He joins Edgar, who's sitting at the scorekeeper's desk and drawing stick figures on the acetone sheet, grinning to see them projected overhead.
"Ready to get your ass whooped," Jesse says.
He picks up a ball, hefts it.
"You ain't no good," Edgar says. "You ain't no better than me."
They start a game. Every once in a while, Jesse looks toward the bar and catches a glimpse of Jehona, and every time, it makes him smile. Even better. Once or twice, he catches her looking at him. And she's smiling, too. Chapter 6.
The only thing on television is a war story with John Wayne. Sometimes Jesse'll talk like him, joshing me, but not tonight. He's been quiet since we got back from bowling. I ask him, does he want to play Crazy Eights or Nickel Knock? Watch a show, he says. I'm thinking. I lay there petting Abby and thinking, too. I think about Mama. I'm having trouble remembering her again. I can see her shape, but where her face should be is like rippling water. Same with Daddy and JP and Peggy and Aunt Beulah. They're fading away. Mama used to say all we got is family, which means I got nothing now. Nothing but Jesse, and him barely. He tells me I'll grow into being alone, but that's him, not me. We ain't all alike. There's good men and bad men, brave men and cowards. Some are on the run from the past, and some want to keep it with them. I can't help it, I'm crying. Abby climbs on my chest and licks my face. What's the matter, Jesse says. I don't want to tell, but it busts out of me. I'm missing Mama. You want to look at the pictures, Jesse says. He goes to his grip and takes out the album, and I sit with him on the bed. He points to the first picture. This is Mama and this is Daddy, he says. On their wedding day, I say. They went to Mr. Borden's studio directly from church to get a photograph made, and Mama said to Mr. Borden, I better look pretty in it or we ain't paying. I got the same eyes as her, same nose. Jesse always says whenever I forget her, I can look in the mirror. Jesse favors Daddy. Not so tall, but seeming bigger. Crow-black hair and eyes. The girl's pouty lips. He's got a smile like Daddy's, too. One you don't see much, but when you do, makes you smile, too. I think he looks like Elvis Presley. He says, I need glasses. The next picture's the whole family. Mama, Daddy, Jesse when he was 7, sister Peg when she was 5, brother JP when he was 3, and me just born. Jesse says, you remember what we called you? You all called me Butterbean, I say. Because you look just like one, Jesse says. I say, you know what they should have called you? What, Jesse says, turd, I say. Because that's what you look like. Jesse turns the pages. Daddy kissing a shovel at the mine. Peg in her coffin after a fever took her. All us on a trip to the ocean. I say to Jesse, you're 14 here and I'm 7. See, Jesse says, you remember. I say, I like this picture of Mama where she's smiling. I run my finger over her face. You're my special child, she told me. The one will be with me forever. The one will take care of me when I'm old. I will, Mama, I said. Don't you worry. And I did. I was the one who took care of her after JP moved to Norfolk to work at the shipyard and after Jesse went away. He ran off one night and we didn't see him again for 30 years. Because you turned, I say to him. It wasn't safe no more for him in Monongah. He had to hit the road. Had to light out for the territory. I asked him, was he an outlaw in those days? He said, buddy, I was whatever I had to be. Claudine, the girl who turned him, the one he run off with, got dusted somewhere along the way. He's been sad ever since. In Monongah, the world kept turning, as Mama would say. Daddy got blown up in the explosion at the mine. JP broke his neck falling off a destroyer he was building. Aunt Beulah ate a bad mushroom and her liver quit. In the end, only me and Mama was left. When she got sick, she sent for Jesse. Turned out she knew all along where to ride him. I asked why she was calling him home. I said, I can keep looking after you. I don't doubt that, hon, she said, but who's going to look after you? It snowed the day she died, and for a week after. The gravedigger said he got blisters on blisters planting her in the frozen ground. Jesse bought her a new dress to be buried in and a casket with white silk lining. I didn't tell nobody he was back. Only me and Cousin Ray knew. Jesse said he'd give Ray the house for holding the funeral and keeping his mouth shut. If you give him the house, where am I going to live? I asked Jesse. He told me not to worry. The next night he sat me at the kitchen table and said he was leaving again, but this time taking me with him. I asked where we was going. Out west, he said. Where the buffalo roam. I asked him, could I get a horse? Because I didn't know nothing then. I hadn't been anywhere or seen anything. That's why he was able to trick me like he did. He made a cut on his arm and told me to drink the blood that come up. Said it was a ceremony we had to do before we left. like when you was baptized, he said. Mama made pancakes when I got baptized. That's what I was thinking while I did what he asked. Maybe I'll get pancakes. I put my mouth to the cut and drank the blood, never guessing my own brother was fucking me. Because that's how the little devil snuck inside. He hid in a bubble, and I swallowed him down with the blood. A week later, he started whispering in a voice so soft I first thought it was my own mind. Every day he got louder, till finally he was howling so I couldn't hear myself thinking, thrashing about like a salted slug. Feed me, you son of a bitch, you cocksucker, you fool. And I've been grappling with him ever since. I feel better after looking at the pictures. I can see Mama again, hear her laughing at my foolishness. I tell Jesse we should get a camera. What for, he asks. I tell him to make pictures, to remember things. There's nothing worth remembering, he says. All right, I say, how about a CB radio? He puts the album back in his grip. We don't have any use for a CB radio either, he says. Firecrackers, then, I say, for 4th of July. How about that? That's all I need, he says, for you to blow your fingers off. I try not to hold against him what he did to me. I understand it's the only way we could stay together, and I understand that's what Mama wanted, but if I knew in the kitchen in Monongo what I know now, that I'd be at the beck and call of a blood-sucking monster till the ocean dries up and the sun falls out of the sky, I'd kick in that knife and cut Jesse's heart out right there. That's a sin even to think, but a small one considering.
Chapter 7. June 27, 1976, near Truckee, California. Over the last 24 hours, the scab of civilization has been torn away and the rot that festers beneath revealed to me. I learned there are monsters that pass as men, and that the night nurtures unspeakable crimes. And my own hands have been stained with blood. You'll think I've gone crazy as you read what I'm about to set down. I'm having trouble believing it myself, but Wanda, baby, every word is true. I spent yesterday morning parked on Virginia, Reno's main drag, a street lined with casinos and souvenir shops. Hungover tourists glanced at the poster and the photos of Benny, but none took me seriously. Neither did the street preacher who thrust his sweaty Bible into the air, laid a hand on my shoulder, and bellowed a prayer before asking for a donation. I called Howard and let him know I was in town. It seemed only right. As he did last time I passed through, he invited me to stay with him and Mary. And as I did last time, I said I was fine sleeping in the Econoline. "That's hurtful," he said. "You're my brother-in-law. Wanda'll never forgive me for not talking you into bedding down at our house." "She'll forgive you," I said. "She knows better than anyone I'm not fit company these days." "At least meet me for lunch," he said. I felt I could handle that. He's family, after all. He chose the place, the Gold and Silver Inn, a greasy spoon near the freeway. He was already sitting with a glass of iced tea in front of him when I got there. He had a badge pinned to his chest with his name and the title Supervisor, Physical Plant, on it. So he must have come directly from work. "You know, I've always liked Howard. He'll talk your ear off, but he also listens. And you can see he's thinking about what you're telling him rather than just waiting to go on about himself. You once told me he never got to be a kid because he had to step up when your father died and take care of the younger children while your mother worked. Cook for them, bathe them, see they got off to school. That stuck with me, because I was a hellion as a boy. A heedless fool who didn't give a damn about anybody but myself. While Howard was changing diapers and washing dishes, I was swiping cigarettes and chasing tail, and I'll bet he's probably still a better person than me." He waved me to his table when he saw me come in, ignored the hand I stuck out, and gave me a hug instead. "Look at that scruff," he said. I tugged at my beard. "It's easier just to let the damn thing grow when you're always on the move," I said. "It's cool," he said. "You got kind of a Moses thing going on, or, hey, Marvin Gaye." "I'd rather be Marvin than Moses," I said. Moses had God's ear, but Marvin, he's got all the money. Howard gave the joke a heartier laugh than it deserved. I could tell he was uncomfortable behind his smile. We sat and fumbled with our napkins and silverware. "How you been?" he said. There was no sense in lying. "It's been rough," I told him. "Lonely days and lonelier nights." He nodded like he understood and said, "How long do you think you can keep it up?" "As long as it takes to find out who killed Benny," I said. "Nobody's going to do this if I don't." "The police," he began. "The police have given up," I said. "They gave up a long time ago. Do you know how many murders go unsolved every year?" One of the detectives had the gall to ask me. "That's the way it is sometimes," he said. The waitress brought me a cup of coffee. Howard waited in silence while I stirred in cream and sugar. Someone was playing a slot machine in the bar. I heard the lever being pulled and the reel spinning and clicking. "Listen," Howard said. "I'm not going to pretend I know what it's like to lose a child, and I admire your dedication. But maybe there comes a point where you have to accept the tragedies life throws at you." I took out my wallet and opened it to a photo of Benny. "You remember this kid, don't you?" I said. "That laugh he had that made everybody else laugh? At what point am I supposed to forget that?" "I'm not saying you have to forget him," Howard replied. "He hid a stray dog in his room for a month," I said. "Wanda hates dogs, but he convinced her to let him keep it. He was tender-hearted, couldn't stand to see anything suffer. I took that for weakness and was hard on him when I shouldn't have been. I said things to him that haunt me, things that made him leave home." Howard reached across the table and laid a hand on my arm. "Charles," he said, "Charles, listen to me. Benny was a drug addict. He was a prostitute. He got into a car with the wrong person. That's the truth of it. The ugly truth. You feel guilty about what you said to him, and maybe you should. But you also got to know that whenever someone dies, someone else always wishes they'd set things right with them before." I felt my anger building. It doesn't take much to set me off these days. All of a sudden, it was all I could do to keep from pounding my fist on the table. "So you're another one like that detective," I said. "Gonna tell me how it is?" "I'm here for the sake of my sister," Howard said. "You feel bad about Benny, but what about Wanda? You cleaned out the bank accounts when you left. And while you've been running around conducting your investigation, she's been working 60 hours a week to keep up the mortgage on your house. She's been busting her ass to pay bills and buy groceries. She's been going to bed every night, not knowing where you are and wondering if you're ever coming back. When's the last time you even called her?" "To say what?" I asked him. "I'm failing out here? I'm chasing my own tail?" "What you need to do," he said, "and I'm telling you this with nothing but love, is get your ass home and take care of the living instead of obsessing over the dead." What he said made sense, but sense has no place in the new world I woke into the day I got the call about Benny's murder. For a year afterward, I pretended things were the same as they'd been before, that I was the same. I went to work every day, I came home and sat down to dinner with you, and I went to bed at 9 every evening. Most nights, though, I lay wide awake, begging God to let me sleep. I tried hard, baby, but I realized I was fooling myself. I realized the old world I'd been living in died along with Benny, and I'd been stranded in a new one where madness and cruelty were the norm. How to explain this to a good woman like you, though? All you'd have heard would have been the raving of a lunatic. So I didn't try. I snuck off instead. Set out on this mission of mine.
and it would have been just as impossible to explain myself to Howard. I finished my coffee, stood slowly so as not to explode, and spoke softly lest I shatter every window in the place. "Good to see you," I said.
"Hold on now, goddammit, hold on," Howard said.
"Give my love to Mary and the boys." I tottered out of the diner, feeling like I was carrying 1,000 extra pounds. I started breathing easier when I reached the Econoline, but fresh air wasn't enough. I needed something more to keep me going. I needed a sign I was on the right path.
"Be careful what you wish for," they say.
As I fumbled for my key, desperate to escape before Howard got it into his head to follow me out and press his case, I noticed an old white man standing nearby. His arms were crossed over his chest, and he regarded me through one squinted eye, the other hidden behind a black patch.
"You all right?" he said.
His voice sounded like gravel in a garbage disposal.
"I'm fine," I replied.
He jerked his chin at the shoe polish please scrawled on the van.
"Your son was murdered?"
"He was."
"How?"
"What's it to you?"
"Throat cut? Bled out? Killed one place, dumped another?"
I examined the man more closely. He wore blue coveralls and had the steel gray flat top haircut and broomstick up the ass posture of an ex-soldier. "They found him in a trash bin in Los Angeles," I said. "2 years ago."
"My wife was buried in the desert outside Tonopah," he said. "Coyotes dug up her remains, and a crew of linemen happened upon them."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said. Hot wind blasted across the parking lot, scattering trash and rocking the Econoline. The sky was the color of dirt, the sun missing in action.
"Let's go to my house and talk," the man said.
"I don't think so," I replied. "You can say what you have to say here."
"I could," the man said, "but I won't. And besides, it's not so much what I've got to say as what I've got to show you."
In my search for Benny's murderer, I've wasted time on mad scientists, fallen under the spell of false prophets, and been led to lots of dead ends by conspiracy theorists of every stripe. This one-eyed man was different, I could tell. Those of us in pain are sensitive to pain in others. We're tuned to the distinctive frequencies of grief. "How far?" I said.
20 miles, the man said. "My name's Czarnecki. Follow me in your van."
He walked to an old green Ford pickup crowned with a camper, got in, and pulled out of the lot. We headed up into the hills, south of town. He drove 50 miles an hour, whether he was on the freeway or on a twisty two-lane mountain road. We turned off into a dirt track somewhere near Truckee. The road ended a few miles and a couple of creek crossings later, at a cabin and some outbuildings spread over an acre of sagebrush and ponderosa pines. Czarnecki parked in front of the cabin. A blue jay harangued me from the top of a tree as I joined him. The cabin was old but solid. A rocking chair waited on the porch next to a coffee can full of sand and cigarette butts. An American flag hung next to the front door. Czarnecki led me into the one-room structure. A sofa, a TV, a bed in one corner with a sleeping bag on it instead of sheets. A sink, a refrigerator, a stove, a table with two chairs. There was some clutter, antique bottles lined up on the mantel above the stone fireplace, rusty branding irons, taxidermied animals, but everything looked to have been arranged, not strewn haphazardly.
"Want a beer?"
Czarnecki said, going to the refrigerator. "No thanks," I said. He tore a tab off of a can of Budweiser and took a seat at the table.
"I don't suppose you'll sit either," he said.
"I'm fine where I am," I said. I wanted to be ready to make a quick getaway if necessary. Czarnecki lit a cigarette and contemplated the match after he'd blown it out.
How long have you been looking for your boy's killer? He said.
It's been a year now, I said.
Got any suspects?
No, but I have some theories.
The circumstances do make a man ponder,
Czarnecki said.
Abducted somewhere. Killed and drained of blood somewhere else. Body left somewhere else. That's not a robbery, that's a ritual. I like to drove myself nuts ruminating over it.
He paused to take a hit off his cigarette. A long, deep drag he released with a hiss.
Then I found Mr. Otto, he said. Or rather, Mr. Otto found me. He turned up one day at my old place in Carson City, the house I shared with Marjorie, my wife. This was a couple of years after her murder, a couple of years where I hadn't been doing much but drinking. Drinking and pondering. I'd like to talk to you about your wife, Mr. Otto said. What about her? I said. Skeptical, like you.
He paused again, and I realized he was fighting tears.
Everything changed for me that day, he said. And everything's going to change for you today.
He finished his beer in a gulp.
Come with me.
I followed him outside. The jay was still squawking. A warning, I now realize. Nature raising an alarm. I should have heeded it. I should have gotten into the Econoline and driven away as fast as I could. But Czarnecki had hooked me, piqued my curiosity. We went to a concrete block shed with a thick wooden door. Czarnecki opened a padlock and folded back a steel hasp. The door creaked when he pushed it. Blood was racing through my veins. I could feel it in my wrists, in my throat. The big orange afternoon sun shot fire into the windowless shed. In the middle of the tomb-like space was a cot. On the cot, a blanket. Under the blanket, what? Czarnecki stepped into the shed and yanked off the cover. The sun shone on a figure lying on the cot, a white man. A kid, really. Naked except for underwear. He was in handcuffs, and his feet were shackled too, at the ankles. The restraints were attached by a chain to an eye bolt embedded in the concrete floor. When the sunlight hit him, he screamed like a wounded animal and writhed in agony. What the fuck? He wailed. What the fuck? He threw his arms up to protect his face from the glare, and his flesh started to smoke. Czarnecki pulled me into the shed and slammed the door shut, plunging the room into darkness. He yanked a string to turn on a bare bulb dangling from the ceiling. The kid quieted. He was 20 or so, with blonde hair and blue eyes. The skin on his forehead, his arms, his legs, wherever the sun's rays had touched him, was black and blistered. The stench of it made me retch, and I retreated in horror until my back was against the door. Before my eyes, the wounds began to heal. The charred areas flattened and softened, and new flesh spread like melting wax to cover the lesions.
Isn't that something?
Czarnecki said. I had no response.
You can shoot them, stab them, run over them with your car, and they'll come right back from it.
Pretty soon, it was as if the boy had never been burned at all. As his pain eased, he regarded me with a disdainful sneer that revealed a gold tooth up front. He was so thin. His elbows and knees were swollen knobs, and you could count his ribs. There was a tattoo of a butterfly on his chest. Enough for now. My fingers are too weak to hold this pen, my mind too tired to remember clearly. I'll get some sleep and set the rest down later. Unless I wake and find this has all been a bad dream. Please let that be so. Today's passage. Everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. John chapter 3, verse 20.
Chapter 8.
The fiends make the ride to Phoenix over 2 nights, with a stop in Alpine to wait out the sun. They keep to deserted back roads, hogging both lanes and rocketing through sleeping one-horse towns. At one point, they come upon a pickup truck rattling home from some late-night mischief and speed up to overtake and surround it. 8 black Harleys ridden by 8 leather-clad devils materialize out of the darkness, and the truck's driver is buffeted by the bone-jarring rumble and soul-deep throb of the bike's engines. The fiends laugh at the yokel's jaw-dropping beneath his cowboy hat and roar off. Disappearing, the driver swears later in a cloud of smoke and swirling sparks. They get to Phoenix just before dawn and check into the Apache Motel. That evening, Antonia calls George Moore's man. The guy is some kind of hawkshaw, some kind of a bounty hunter. He doesn't offer his name. McMullen is flopping at the Sandman on Van Buren, he says, but he's at a ball game tonight at the stadium. Antonia hangs up and joins the rest of the fiends by the motel's swimming pool, drops onto a chaise next to Elijah. Real Deal, Bob One, and Johnny Kickapoo are roughhousing in the water like unruly children. The rest of the gang slam dominoes on a round metal table with a metal umbrella hovering above it. A transistor radio blares a rock and roll station. The motel's owner has asked them twice to turn the music down, but they crank it back up as soon as he returns to the office. Nobody's worried about him calling the cops. The motel is lousy with hookers, thieves, and dopers. Johnny Kickapoo climbs out of the pool. He got his nickname because he hung around the Kickapoo Reservation while growing up in Oklahoma. He doesn't have a drop of native blood in him. His black hair and eyes come from his Italian mother, his prominent nose from his German father. But he pretends he's part Indian. He even wears a feather in his hair. He bares his ass at the other swimmers and jumps back in with his knees pulled to his chest. The resulting explosion sends the pool's pale blue light skittering over the dying palms drooping overhead. Above them, the stars, unmoved, as Antonia and Elijah discuss the hit. Normally, the next team up in the rotation, in this case Real Deal and Yuma, would do the job and split half the payment, minus 10% to Monsieur Beaumont, and the rest of the gang would divide the remaining half equally. The baby, Moore has promised, throws a wrench into the works. An infant is special for a rover. Feed on one, and instead of having to feed again the next month, you can go a whole year. Something about the blood. You'd think then it would be open season on babies, but in the same way that con men are known to be as gullible as their marks, rovers are a superstitious lot, and a venerable bit of lore keeps most of them away from infants. Steal a child, the warning goes, and you'll wind up dusted soon after. Antonia scoffs at this fear. She understands that it's simply the childish spookifying of the real danger connected to snatching babies. The disappearance of an infant upsets the public much more than if a vagrant or a whore suddenly drops off the face of the earth. It makes people much more likely to form posses, mount searches, and scrutinize strangers, all of which could mean disaster for a rover. But since the fiends didn't grab the baby in question, and in fact have no idea how Moore got it, they'd all be comfortable feeding on the child. Even if it's shared with a partner, that's still 6 months of not having to hunt, not having to wonder where your next get-right is coming from, and not having to worry about being caught draining some rummy. 6 months when you could get off the road and relax if you wanted to. That's why Antonia tells Elijah it's only fair they make an exception to the rotation this time and allow everyone a chance at the jackpot. That won't go over well, Elijah says. And he's right. You can't be changing how we do things whenever you want, Real Deal says when Antonia has gathered everyone around the umbrella table. It's me and Yuma's turn. We do the job and the baby's ours. Right, Yuma says. Luck of the draw. It could have been any of us. If you two weren't up, you'd be begging for a chance at the brat, Pedro says. But we don't have to beg, Yuma says, because the rules are the rules. Bob, too, tosses a beer can. Pedro shakes a finger in Yuma's face. War's about to break out. Antonia wraps her knuckles on the table to quiet the shouting. We'll take a vote, she says. Do we stick with the regular rotation, or do we give everybody a shot at the kid? Everyone but Yuma and Real Deal votes to make an exception. The pair sit there steaming, but what can they do? They're outnumbered. How do we decide who makes the hit? Bob One asks. We'll roll for it, Antonia replies. One person per team, Winners do the job and get the kid. The rest split the money. Elijah grabs a pair of dice out of the domino box. They agree to let Yuma go first. She shakes the bones and tosses them on the table. Gets a 7 for her and Real Deal. Johnny rolls a 9, and Antonia throws a 3 for her and Elijah. Then it's Bob One's turn. He whispers to the dice, blows on them, shakes them over his head. When he finally flings them, he gets 2 6s.
Boxcars!
Bob Two shouts. The party breaks up. Too much disappointment and resentment in the air. Everyone shuffles off to their rooms except the Bobs, who celebrate their good fortune until the first rays of sunshine, leaping over the horizon, chase them inside.
See it?
Bob Two says. He points out a giant rat, a foot long from its nose to the tip of its tail. The beast creeps up on a Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket lying in the gutter. Poking its head inside, it pulls out a half-eaten drumstick and rears back on its haunches to gnaw it.
What the fuck did you show me that for?
Bob One says. You know I can't abide vermin. They're sitting in an ice cream parlor across the street from the Sandman Motel. They've been here almost an hour, since right after sunset. Came over as soon as it was safe. Their table has a view of McMullen's room and of the rat, which is rooting in the bucket again.
A rat's gotta be smart to get that big, Bob Two says. Gotta be able to sniff out poison, fight off dogs, think on its feet.
Fuck 'em, Bob One says. They should all die. You never heard of the Black Death? I tried to feed on a rat once. Stop right there. I got so desperate, I went to a dump and chased one down. Tasted like shit and didn't help at all.
It's a good thing you hooked up with me, isn't it?
Bob One says.
I was doing okay on my own, Bob Two says.
Feeding on rats is not doing okay. The men have been partners for 25 years. Bob One was born in 1904 in Key West. He grew up working on fishing boats, got married, had a kid. At 22, he fell for a Cuban girl he met on Mallory Square, a Cuban girl who'd come out only at night. They decided to run away to Havana, and Bob had her turn him, thinking they'd be lovers until the end of time. The night before they were supposed to sail, the girl disappeared, and Bob never saw her again. Bob, too, is from Brooklyn, born in 1923. He fought in France during the Second World War, killed a lot of men, and saw a lot of men die. This triggered his first and only existential crisis. What was the point of grubbing through life when the only possible ending was death? When a hooker he was jungled up with after returning to the States confided that she was a rover and would likely live forever, he saw a way to ease his mind. He forced the girl to turn him, then dusted her so nobody in the world knew his new secret. His plan worked perfectly. He hasn't worried about dying since. The Bobs met in Kansas City and started traveling together. When your survival depends on hunting down and killing another human being every 30 days, it's smart to have someone watching your back. They make quite a pair. Bob One is tall and thin and fair, and Bob Two is short and round and dark. Bob One is kind of quiet, but Bob Two talks enough for both of them. They get on each other's nerves, but also make each other laugh more than anyone else can. One night, a few years into their relationship, one thing led to another, and they ended up rolling around in bed. It was more like fighting than fucking, and both of them felt okay afterward, so they've kept it up. It's nothing they plan, just something that happens now and then. 4 years ago, they fell in with the Fiends, again thinking about safety in numbers, but also looking to make some money, and it's been a wild ride ever since. Bob Two finishes his coffee and scrutinizes the menu board on the wall.
The Bicentennial Special, he says.
What? Bob One says.
Cherry, vanilla, and blueberry on a sugar cone.
Knock yourself out. Bob Two goes to the counter. The high school girl scooping sundaes and working the register is scared of him and Bob One. He can tell. Their long hair, their beards, their tattoos.
Good. The more scared people are, the better.
Give me that Bicentennial thing, he says. Movement at the motel catches Bob One's eye. He straightens from his board slouch and puts his face to the window. A man steps out of the room they've been watching. He matches Moore's description of McMullen, and a black rover aura shimmers around him. He makes sure his door is locked, shoves his hands in his pockets, and walks toward the ice cream parlor. Bob One stands and calls to the girl.
Where's the back door?
He and Bob 2 dashed through a storage room and out into an alley behind the shop. Hurrying to the end of the alley, Bob 1 peeks around the corner and watches McMullen enter the ice cream parlor. A bell rings when the door opens. Bob 1 pulls his head back and takes a bag of sunflower seeds out of his pocket. He tosses some into his mouth and cracks them between his teeth.
"You aren't going to keep an eye on him," Bob 2 says.
"You didn't hear that bell." A few minutes later, the bell rings again. McMullen leaves the shop, carrying a cup of coffee. He crosses Van Buren and gets into a Dodge Dart parked in front of his room, starts it up, and pulls out of the lot. The Bobs dash to the Hornet they stole in order to be less conspicuous than they would be on their Harleys. They keep a car between them and the Dart as they follow McMullen. He makes his way to a drive-in theater and turns into the entrance. Bob 2 pulls to the side of the road. The jittery red and yellow neon on the back of the giant movie screen dances across the hood of the Hornet.
"What now?" Bob 2 says.
"I guess we're going to the show," Bob 1 replies. They join the line of cars waiting to enter the drive-in, pay the admission fee at the booth, and cruise the lot, looking for McMullen. When they find where he's parked, they pull into an empty slot two rows behind, between a couple of teenagers in a Volkswagen Beetle and a family sitting in lawn chairs in the bed of a pickup. Bob 2 takes the speaker off the post and hangs it from the window, but turns the sound down. The film has already started. Clint Eastwood, 50 feet tall, squints and draws his gun. Bob 1 watches McMullen's car, while Bob 2, imitating a play-by-play announcer, keeps up a running commentary on the action in the Volkswagen.
"Here we go, folks," he says. "Johnny Fuckerfaster is making a move on Susie Rottencrotch. He's got his hands up her blouse and is trying to sneak under her bra. Meanwhile, Susie's petting his trouser snake. Young love, ladies and gentlemen, young love. You can't beat that."
McMullen gets out of the Dart and heads for the cinderblock snack bar. He's a little guy with an unruly mop of curly red hair.
"There he goes," Bob 1 says.
"I've got a plan," Bob 2 says.
"Clue me in. Come running when I signal."
Bob 2 slides out of the Hornet and walks to the Dart. A gunfight erupts on the screen, and shots ping out of every speaker on the lot. The driver's door of the Dodge is unlocked. Bob opens it and pops the lock on the rear door. Opening that, he climbs in and lies down behind the front seat. He made the garrote he takes from his pocket himself, a length of thin wire with wooden handles at both ends. Crunching gravel telegraphs McMullen's return. Bob grips the garrote tighter. The front door opens, and the overhead light goes on. The Dart rocks as McMullen slides in with his popcorn and soda. He closes the door, and the light goes out. Bob sits up, slips the loop of wire over McMullen's head, and yanks the handles. The wire digs into McMullen's throat. He drops the popcorn and struggles silently, the garrote cutting off his voice as well as his air. He claws at the wire, trying to pry it from his windpipe. His legs spasm and his feet kick the underside of the dash. Bob uses all his weight to draw the wire even tighter, nearly pulling McMullen into the back seat. McMullen's eyes bulge. His tongue protrudes from his mouth like a snail stretched to its limit. Bob takes both handles of the garrote in one hand and with the other draws a hunting knife from a sheath on his belt. He leans forward and drives the knife into McMullen's chest, angling it so the blade slides between two ribs and plunges into the man's heart. McMullen's arms drop, his eyes close, and he slumps in his seat. Bob climbs out of the back of the Dart and opens the front door. He pushes McMullen over and slips behind the wheel. The keys are in the ignition. Two flashes of the car's brake lights bring Bob 1 running. He's carrying a duffel bag.
"Get him?" he says.
"What's it look like?"
Bob 1 dives into the back seat. Bob 2 hangs the speaker on the post and makes for the exit, leaving the Hornet behind. He takes it slow, but McMullen's head still bounces off the passenger window a few times. When they're in the clear, Bob 1 leans over the seat to look at the body.
"It go easy," he says.
"I hit him like an A-bomb," Bob 2 says.
"Boom. Boom."
They pull over on an empty stretch of road outside town. Saueros stand out against the starry sky, and jagged black hills disrupt the horizon. Bob 2 drags McMullen's body out of the Dart and drops it on its back. Bob 1 unzips the duffel bag and takes out a Polaroid camera. He snaps a couple of photos as proof for more. McMullen's face, a tattoo on his forearm, then goes back into the bag for a hatchet.
"You want me to dust him?" he says. My hit, Bob Two says. I'll do it.
He grabs McMullen's hair and lifts his head. Bob One passes him the hatchet, and he raises it high and brings it down on McMullen's neck. Flesh splits, and bone crunches. The guy's head comes off so suddenly after only three whacks that Bob nearly loses his balance. He drops the head, and he and Bob One watch it and McMullen's body disintegrate into gray powder, leaving only his clothes. Bob One goes through the pockets of the pants, removing a wallet and motel key. The shirt yields a pack of chewing gum. The wind gusts and carries away most of the ash. Bob tosses the shirt high in the air, and it sails flapping across the desert, all the ghost McMullen will have.
You want his shoes, Bob One says. You ever see me wear sneakers? Bob Two replies.
They drive into town, abandon the dart in a shopping mall parking lot, and ride their Harleys back to the Apache. Chapter 9. Edgar sways and grunts and jabs at the flipper buttons on a pinball machine. Jesse's at the bar. They've returned to the bowling alley after Jesse lay awake all day, buffeted by a flood of memories triggered by meeting Johanna, memories he thought were lost to him for good. There Claudine was, humming French songs in the moonlight. There she was, sipping champagne in a San Francisco hotel, New Year's Eve, 1902. There she was, the shine of her hair, the swish of her skirts, the seaside rhythm of her breath in sleep. Time devours memories, gnaws the meat off them and crunches the bones. Jesse's always considered this a blessing. Better to be focused on the here and now when you're forever on the hunt, forever being hunted. Better not to be daydreaming about Mama's peach pie or a departed lover's touch. But maybe he's been wrong. Because tonight, for the first time in a long while, he doesn't wish he was dead. In fact, after spending hours caught up in the torrent of reminiscence, he felt as if a crust of mud that had been weighing him down had cracked and fallen away. That's why, as soon as the sun set, he roused Edgar and said, "Let's go back to that place we were last night." Johanna was behind the bar, as he'd hoped. "Howdy, stranger," she said. And he'd be damned if she didn't even have the beauty mark on her lip Claudine had. He set Edgar up in front of the game and went back to the bar and ordered a beer. Johanna's been busy ever since, however. The place is packed, and there are drinks to be poured, jokes to be laughed at. Jesse doesn't mind. It's a thrill watching her scoop ice, watching her make change. She stops by whenever she gets a chance, sighs, and says, "You good?" and, "I'm about to lose my voice, screaming over all this noise." She lights a cigarette, takes two quick puffs, and stubs it out in an ashtray with a conspiratorial wink. She shakes her hips to the beat of a song and glances over to make sure he saw. When her hand brushes his, time collapses in on itself, old feelings and new crashing head on. At 10, she slaps the bar and says, "So where are we going?" "What do you mean?" Jesse says. "I'm off," she says. "Where are you taking me? And don't you dare say another bar." Jesse hesitates. He should end this flirtation now. As much as he's drawn to the girl, going any further will only be courting trouble. Nothing good ever comes of the turned consorting with the unturned. But then she smiles Claudine's smile again, and a worry she's misread him ripples across her face, and in the second between the needle of the jukebox dropping onto a record and the song starting to play, he throws caution to the wind. "Are you hungry?" he asks. "Always," she replies. "I've got my brother with me. He can chaperone. Meet me in the parking lot in 10 minutes. Edgar's run out of quarters and so is pretending to play the pinball machine, making sounds with his mouth. He whines about having to leave, but brightens at the mention of food. "Now listen, there's a girl coming with us," Jesse tells him. "You gonna feed?" Edgar says. "No, she's a friend of mine." "You ain't got any friends. You best behave yourself." "I know how to act," Edgar says. He stands up straight, clicks his heels, and bows like someone he's seen on television. "May I kiss your hand?" he says. "No fucking around. I mean it," Jesse says. They wait for Johanna in the parking lot, Jesse so nervous that he's bouncing on his toes. Johanna comes through the door, laughing and waving goodbye to someone inside. "You're here," she says to Jesse, kidding like she thought he wouldn't be. "This is Edgar," Jesse says. "Edgar, this is Johanna.
Pleased to make your acquaintance, Miss Johanna, Edgar says. You sure are pretty.
They walk to the Grand Prix.
You ride in back. Let Johanna up front, Jesse says to Edgar. I got shotgun, Edgar says. I always got shotgun.
It's cool, Johanna says. I like riding in back.
He has the mind of a child, Jesse says as he opens the door for her.
Me too, Johanna says. We'll get along great.
She directs Jesse to a Mexican restaurant that's the last business hanging on in a dying strip mall. Says it makes the best chimichangas in the world. The hostess seats them in an orange vinyl booth. A menagerie of piñatas hangs from the ceiling, and the Coors sign on the wall has a moving waterfall. Jesse and Johanna order beers. Edgar wants one too, but Jesse says, he'll have a Coke. Johanna talks nonstop, flitting from subject to subject so quickly that Jesse gets lost sometimes. When he does, he just smiles and nods, content to let her enthusiasm wash over him without worrying about keeping up.
You've never heard of Neil Young, she says.
He hasn't, nor Led Zeppelin, Slaughterhouse 5, Charlie's Angels, or any of the other things she chatters about. When she asks, what TV shows do you watch? He's embarrassed not to have an answer.
I like wrestling, he says.
I see Dragnet sometimes. The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger, Johanna says. Okay, Pops.
Edgar is pretending his straw wrapper is a snake, slithering it between the salt shaker and the basket of tortilla chips. He doesn't like spicy food, so Jesse orders him a hamburger. Johanna moves on to stories about her friends, Tracy and Pam and Eddie and Carlos. One of them was busted for a joint, but his dad knew the judge and got him off. Another works at a drugstore where the pharmacist keeps cornering her in the back room and telling her he and his wife have an open marriage.
He's so gross, Johanna says. He looks like Jackie Gleason. You know who that is, don't you?
Edgar pipes up with, to the moon, Alice!
Johanna laughs and says to him, well, you know anyway.
When the food comes, she sits back and claps a hand over her mouth.
I haven't shut up since we got here, she says.
I don't mind, Jesse says. My life's boring compared to yours.
I don't believe you, Johanna says. Tell me about it.
There's not much to tell.
You do construction.
Sometimes.
What about the other times?
Jesse makes up something new.
I sell cars.
Man, Johanna says, I really wanted you to be a bank robber.
How come?
So when I'm an old lady, I can say I went out with one. I'll say, we only had one night together, but it was glorious.
She's trying to be funny, but Jesse hears something sad in her voice. For the first time since they sat down, there's a silence. She sips her beer and avoids looking him in the eye.
Why'd you ask me out if you're taking off for Denver? She says.
I believe it was you who asked me out, Jesse says,
which was a totally slutty thing to do.
You aren't a slut.
How do you know?
I know.
Johanna scoffs at this.
Anyhow, why'd you say yes then? She says.
You remind me of someone, Jesse says.
A girlfriend?
More than that.
You could be her twin.
So she was super foxy.
She was beautiful.
Johanna wasn't expecting a serious reply. She pauses, then says,
what was her name?
Claudine. Claudine Desjardins.
Though the night Jesse met her, she called herself Pythia. Sees all, knows all, promised the signboard on her booth, one of many lining the midway of a traveling fair set up in a pasture on the edge of Monongah. A month earlier, the same field had been the site of a week-long outdoor revival meeting, which hadn't interested Jesse in the least. The fair, though, with its faintly sinister, faintly salacious air and maze of colorful wagons and patched canvas tents, strummed a restless chord in him. So one Saturday, after 10 hours of drudgery at the sawmill where he'd been working since he'd been old enough to work, he hurried over to see what he could see. The encampment was lit by flaming torches and strings of electric bulbs that shone like little suns. A steam calliope whistled out, a picture